Hello, and welcome to Seedheads, the cross-pollinating podcast where our Canadian seed heroes tell their stories, share their how-to tips, and talk about the seeds they love. I'm your host, Steph Benoit, coming to you from Ottawa, Ontario, on the traditional unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg people. In this episode, I had the pleasure of chatting with Greg Wingate. Greg is the sole proprietor of Maple Farm, located in what he describes as the backwoods of Albert County, New Brunswick, just south of Moncton, on the territory of the Mi'kmaq and Wabanaki peoples. Started in 1989, Maple Farm bears the distinction of being one of the oldest seed companies in the Maritimes. During our conversation, we talked about some of the many varieties Greg has come to know and love in his over 30 years of running Maple Farm. And we discussed his philosophy around seeing gardening and seed growing first and foremost as an adventure. Greg was such a great guest to chat with, and I hope you enjoy listening to the episode as much as I did recording it. Thank you so much for making the time to join us this morning. It's always fun to have people on who have been in it for a little bit longer and have all of these stories to tell of sort of how things have changed and the things they've seen.
My pleasure.
To begin with, I was hoping you can tell us a little bit about the history of Maple Farm, why you started it, what the unique growing conditions are in your area, and how you've seen it change over time.
Okay, well, it was back in the late 70s when I was looking for a property that this particular place came available. It was lots of woods and a very reasonable price because it was way back in the woods. I had no road frontage. There's a gravel road that's about a kilometer long to get to the beginning of the property. I've always been kind of a nature boy, and so wanted to just build a cabin. I had worked in the woods. I had worked in house construction, so my dream was to build a log house, and that eventually came to be. And after I built the cabin, I had a little bit of cleared space. This used to be a farm, apparently, back in the 1920s, but they're mostly grown up in woods, beautiful woods, maples and apples and beeches and, you know, all kinds of firs. And it's a paradise for somebody who likes the woods. And then I decided, yeah, to start a little garden. And once I started a garden, I just fell in love with that altogether. That was like miraculous for me, how wonderful an occupation that was. And I loved it so much, I thought, I've got to find some way to make a living out of this so I can do it all the time. So I have, no history in my family of farming or, any formal education in farming. But I had developed an interest in books and magazines that covered gardening and farming. One of the things that spurred me on to thinking I could make a living at it was, well, Organic Farming and Gardening magazine was a little tabloid thing back then. They did a feature on a farm in California that was only about an acre and a half large, and they were making like $150,000 on it back in the 80s.
Wow.
And I thought, yeah. But of course, that's year-round gardening in California. They were selling to high-end restaurants there. But I thought if I could make even a fraction of that on even more land, maybe I could make a go of it. Mm-hmm. Another magazine that I fell in love with and subscribed to back then was Harrowsmith. And they did a feature on a guy from Poland, Ted Maxa. He was called the Fish Lake Garlic Man. And he was surprised moving from Europe to Canada that nobody was growing garlic. He said, what's going on here? Everybody should be growing garlic. We grow it all over Europe, especially in Eastern Europe. And he explained the process, and it seemed from the story it was quite doable. And I thought, geez, maybe I can do the math. Back then, garlic in stores was nothing like you see today. The only way you would get garlic, if it wasn't crushed and minced in a little tiny jar, was that it came in this little package from Gilroy, California, and there were two bulbs to a cardboard tiny box with a little cellophane window on it, and they were going for 79 cents each back then. So I thought, well, I was doing the math thinking, wow, how many garlic can you grow per square foot? And it just, it seemed to make sense to me that it would be something that I could grow not only as a crop for produce, fresh produce, but also to get other people growing it so I could grow it and sell it for seed stock. And when I put this to a local nursery, he said, don't even bother to try to sell it in the fall. We'll take it in the spring as a started up potted plant. So I thought, those three ways, there's got to be a way to sell that. And that's what I started with, garlic. I just put an ad in rural delivery and always thought from the start that mail order would be the way to go, because I would always opt for the unusual things. Mm-hmm. And I needed a bigger audience than the Maritimes. So I put an ad in rural delivery that was kind of a starter trial thing for mail order for the Maritimes, and no problem selling out there, and took it from there. Yeah, everything grew from that.
Wow, that's a great origin story. I'm also a huge fan of garlic, so I personally love the fact that garlic was sort of your catalyst for getting involved in this work. So where did that lead to next?
Well, I thought that was so successful that I would go for some other unusual things. And unusual things is what drives me a lot. I address the first page of my brochure for years now, fellow adventurous gardeners, because I'm not in it to be another member of the people who grow commodities. I'm into finding treasure. You know, that's my perspective. And so I had it in my mind to develop niches for things that other people didn't grow. So following garlic, I went to Jerusalem artichokes. Mm-hmm. That was a very unknown. It's still fairly unknown now. Shallots was a natural follow to garlic, because that was sold exactly the same way. It was two to a box. They got a dollar a box for two little shallots. I mean, the garlic box was 3/4 of an ounce. So you can imagine how small those garlic bulbs were.
Oh,
two
wow.
of those. Yeah. And the shallot box was 1 ounce and had two shallots in it. And all that was coming from New Jersey. And I thought, well, the garlic went so well, maybe I can do the shallots too. And so shallots made it onto the list. Jerusalem artichokes, horseradish. Few people were selling horseradish. But I realized then that I'm selling very simple, almost perennial things, you know, that I'm not going to get much repeat business. Once they get these things, they're done with me, unless I begin to grow something they'll come back to me for. And so to give you a little perspective on what drives me here, I remember when I was a kid and you'd go for an ice cream. This is eons ago. You could go, and most of the places they'd sell strawberry, vanilla, or chocolate. And that was the whole list, if not close to the whole list, you know. And, mm-hmm. and when I was young, my father would take us all out to a place called Howard Johnson's, and it said 28 flavors. And I went, holy smokes, 28 flavors. We went there. That became a usual thing, to go to this Howard Johnson's for ice cream. And after 3 or 4 times, Gary, my brother, would always say, what do you want? He says, I'll have strawberry. And I say, Gary, live it up. They got 28 flavors here, you know, don't you? My mind was, I can't wait to try every single one of them. You know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of my perspective with gardening. I'm looking for things that other people don't offer. I don't want to sell commodities. I want to find treasures and share that treasure with other people. So that led me to the seed saving world and joining Seed Savers Exchange. And Seed Savers Exchange was like a eye opener for finding treasure from everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
When I go, I'm asked to give seed saving talks every now and then. I always bring the yearbook and show them the 500 page big book and show them, for instance, the tomato. I've got it in front of me here now. Well, in the beginning of the book, they make the point that for every two varieties that are available commercially, there are three available in this yearbook. So,
wow.
In other words, most of the varieties you can get that are open pollinated, that are, you know, favorable to seed savers, are grown by amateurs, mm-hmm. rather than by companies. And I thought that's a world of finding treasure that has yet to be made available commercially to people.
Mm-hmm.
So I went head first into that. When I give the seed saving talks, I bring the yearbook and I show them, like, it goes from page 365 here to page 438. And that is just for red tomatoes.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And every page has two columns with at least 10 varieties on each column. You add that up, that's thousands and thousands of tomatoes.
Wow.
And so I thought, I can do my own trials here. When I began Mapleform, I was not only doing the seed thing, I was doing the produce thing. So I would be able to order all kinds of things and trial them and see what worked to include in my growing catalog.
Speaking of your catalog and coming back to this idea of adventure and being adventurous with gardening, I was looking through your brochure for this year last night, and I had to Google a few things that I didn't know. I was like, what does Chinese artichoke look like? And what is that compared to regular artichoke or Jerusalem artichoke? So that was kind of a fun, even as someone who spends a little bit of time in the seed and vegetable world, there are still things that I'd never heard of. So that's wonderful.
Yeah, I always wanted to offer things that other people weren't offering, selling the adventure of gardening. Also, the adventure of seed saving. So, for those who wanted something different, I wanted to be the go-to guy for a certain number of things there. I didn't want to sell a commodity. I wanted to sell treasures. I wasn't looking for competition. I was looking to offer things that nobody else had offered before. That's where garlic and shallots and Jerusalem artichokes and those kinds of things started. And when I joined Seed Savers Exchange, I'd be looking for things that other people were growing, but you couldn't find in seed catalogs. And that's what brings us back to something like, you mentioned, was it Chinese artichokes that you mentioned?
Yeah, the Chinese artichokes.
Chinese artichokes?
Look them up.
Yeah, and that's very unusual. In fact, for the longest time, I was the only one in Canada offering that. I got it from a Chinese outfit in Connecticut. And I thought, this is very, and that's a perennial. Once you have that, you have it for life. So that fit my idea of unusual things that provided no competition, which is right up my alley.
It's a pretty good business strategy. If you can just find things that are so unusual that no one else offers them, you've got yourself a lane. You've got yourself a market.
That's exactly what I thought. Yes. And that's what I set out to do. So I address my letter every year to fellow adventurous gardeners. It's something new. And that's what it is for me. I love getting this catalog from Seed Savers Exchange, based in the States, from the Heritage Seed Program in Canada, and seeing what people have to offer that, especially when they're not available commercially. And then I can bring those things to people commercially. For instance, the Mystery Keeper tomato, that was one from a gardener in Ontario. And that's become one of my great sellers because, imagine having a tomato that you can grow and you pick it just as it's kind of mid-ripe towards the end of the season in September, October. And I've had people actually save it right through till the end of June, and this is without processing. This is without special conditions. This is just, in a basket on a counter table. And to me, that was just unbelievable.
Wow, they were keeping that long.
They keep that long. They're mystery keeper. Yeah. And so a lot of people are happy to just have something that keeps till Christmas.
Right.
Or, Valentine's Day. Or for me, the progeny of the seeds that I'm offering now all came from seeds that, made it to Easter easily.
Wow.
And so Lato was the first tomato I offered, and that was because it was the earliest tomato I could find. And I thought, why not go for the earliest you can find? That's and I had developed a strategy of this is pre-internet now, of getting catalogs from wherever I could possibly find them and looking for the quirkiest family farm or seed seller that I could find. And I ran into the Glenn and Linda Drowns in Decorah. So they're not too far away from where the Seed Savers Exchange actually started, which was back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. They offered a whole huge catalog of different seeds. Lata was one that came out of Idaho, and they just offered it as something early. But when I was doing my trials, it was like way earlier than all the early tomatoes I came across, except with the exception of Bradley, which was just behind it. But Bradley produced all at once. Lata produced right through the season.
Oh wow!
And it's like I start that after May, and I'm getting the ripe tomatoes at the end, you know, before the end of July. And I thought that's, and you can, I mean, that's the one tomato seed I could even just start as a seed right into the ground without having to start it inside. You can start that outside and still get, you know, just like any other seed without having to start it early. You can still get ripe tomatoes from it within a season in Canada. And that's, that to me was just wild. And I was then getting, you know, requests from Yellowknife and Labrador and really extreme places saying, wow, this, I've never thought I could grow a ripe tomato before. And that's what I was after, to offer something that was extremely early, that was flavorful and very productive and had a long season going for itself. So I thought that was a find. At that time, there was nobody else in the country that offered it. And now there's all kinds of places in Canada that offer it.
I saw that it was voted the most popular open pollinated tomato in the region by East Coast Magazine around 2000.
Yeah, you saw that.
That's nothing. That's no small accomplishment.
It's fun making these acquaintances with people around the world and sharing what they have with other people that, like me, at one time never even heard of these things. You know, that's kind of cool.
I imagine walking around your garden is a little bit like having a tour of the world in 60 seconds or more than 60 seconds, but going around and getting all of these little snapshots of things that are unusual and cool and quirky from all over the world.
Oh, I love trying that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And bringing it all to the Maritimes. I could see why that would be something that would keep you coming back and being involved with it for a long time.
There's always something new to try, no matter, you know, how many different things you've run into. There's always something new that comes up, and that, you know, I can't help but scratch that itch. You know, you gotta try it. And then if it works, you know, you've got something to offer others.
Do you have some other favorite varieties over your years of being in this business?
Well, the thing that Maple Farm is most known for is sweet potatoes. I don't carry them anymore, but that was probably the thing that Maple Farm is most known for. I first learned about the possibility of growing sweet potatoes from Nancy Buble, who is a garden writer who wrote for Country Journal and talked about how she had success with them in Connecticut. And there was a guy, Roger Klein, who was the vegetable specialist at Cornell, who had done in the early 80s some tests with sweet potatoes and actually found a few varieties that did well in northern New York State. And I thought that was enough for me to say, well, I got to try this. And managed to get some stock from deep down south on the recommendation of what Roger Klein had suggested. And sure enough, I was having success with sweet potatoes in New Brunswick. And I thought, wow, this is too much. And so I offered them just in a rural delivery, which is it's a regional magazine, agricultural magazine in the Maritimes. And coincidentally, Ken Allen, who was a vegetable gardening writer, had done tests the previous year with gardeners across the country on a variety called Georgia Jet. And Harrow Smith had found out that, when he was doing his article, they put me in as a source for sweet potato slips. And I was not prepared for that at all. So all of a sudden I was getting orders from all over the country. There's no way I was very early in the production of that then. And I was getting orders that I just couldn't fill, but it, showed me there was demand for it.
Right.
And for the longest time, and I couldn't believe it, I basically had that to myself. Believe it or not, yeah, there was a guy, his name was Cricket, down in the Carolinas, and he was doing research on, because certified organics was going to make it obligatory that if a variety was available organically, you had to get that if it was available. If not, then you could go outside of the organic community. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted to keep with your certified organic status, you had to buy something. So when I was certified organic very early on and offered sweet potatoes, I was just getting unbelievable requests. In fact, to go back to this guy Cricket down in the South, he was putting together a list. He said, you know, do you realize, he says, you're the only person in the world that has certified organic sweet potato slips available for sale. And I that's what I said. Oh, wow. And so I was in this crazy situation of getting people from the deep South sweet potato growing countries asking me for, you know, a million plants of this, that, or the other. Of course, I said, I have nothing near that kind of capacity, but I always sold out very, very early on. And no matter, I mean, grew as much as I could possibly grow on my own and had always more requests than I could possibly fill, and thought, wow, this is a dream come true. You know, that's like, I can never satisfy the demand for that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So that became the thing I was most known for, was sweet potato slips.
Yeah. And I was reading a little bit about your rationale for sending plants instead of tubers, but I was wondering maybe if you wanted to elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure. Tubers, sweet potato tubers, are very cold sensitive. If you store them, like a lot of produce, if you store them just above freezing, that's the best for them for long shelf life, mm-hmm. long storage capabilities. Sweet potatoes can get what's called chilling injury if they're subjected to temperatures below 50 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, I believe, 10 degrees Celsius. And so if you try to send tubers in the mail when you need them, and you need basically like a couple of months before you want to plant them, there's no way in Canada you can sell those or ship those tubers in the cold season so they're not subject to chilling injury, mm-hmm. so that you can grow your own. So it became way more worthwhile to just send the slips, because the slips are way more cold hardy. They can, as long as they don't freeze, they're okay. And the other thing is that they're way lighter than mm-hmm. tubers themselves. So when you're in mail order, that's a big aspect. And with sweet potatoes, I learned, you know, I started early on starting them just for the local area. But as I developed a clientele, not only across the country, but then into the States, I was starting them as early as I could. And that would be like even in the end of February, I was starting them, and I'd be growing them right through. I would have them available at the end of March, and that was the earliest I could ship so that they wouldn't freeze en route.
Do you think that gardeners are looking for different things now, or has that remained fairly steady, the interest?
I think that's always been evolving. I tend to draw a clientele that's a lot like I am. They're looking for gardening adventures. They're looking for something different. Mm-hmm. And I am glad to oblige, because that is my territory. I'm always looking for something different, something unusual, something that doesn't offer competition, something that's a treasure. And so I've always attracted that kind of like-minded person or gardener. And then again, you're offering something for sale to nurseries and to fellow farmers who want to stand out in some way and go, wow. I mean, I had all kinds of small farmers and small nurseries wanting to add sweet potatoes to their repertoire, because who thought it was even possible to grow them in Canada when I first started? Mm-hmm. In fact, it's funny, when I was very early on, and was just graduating from hand tools to I bought my first walk behind tiller. The fellow who had a used tiller for sale nearby, I went to get it from. He says, "What do you want to do with that, anyways?" And I said, "I want to grow." What was it then? I wanted to grow garlic. And he says, "You can't grow garlic here." He says, "That's, you know, you got to be in California to grow garlic." He was from the States. And he says, "There's no way you're going to be growing garlic here." And I said, "Wow." I didn't tell him about the story in Harrismith that I found. And sure enough, that was an entirely new thing for people at that time. So I've always been on the lookout for something different. And there is a clientele in that. There are other like-minded people who are looking for something different. And it's not just from a gardener's perspective, but from a business perspective. You would get nurseries, you would get farmers who, you know, would be able to sell their wares and say, "Look at this." And people go, "I didn't even know that you could do that here." And so not only would they be able to taste something homegrown, but that they have the capacity to believe that perhaps they could grow it themselves as well if they had that kind of bent. And so that's always where I was coming from.
Listening to you talk, I wonder how much not having a formal training in plant breeding or in gardening or horticulture or whatnot was maybe to your advantage of just having that sense of not having already absorbed this idea of what is or isn't possible and kind of coming at it from this very adventurous perspective. Do you think that might be the case?
I think you're absolutely right on that. There's no question of that. People get taught to think there are things you can't do. And I went into it wide-eyed and bushy-tailed without constraints at all. And it's funny, the books I go to are like 19th century books. The Vegetable Garden by Villemarin and these are outstanding references of all kinds of plants and produce that had to be grown organically because that's all there was then. This was before synthetic inputs. And it's funny that, people coming out of agriculture school now, and a lot of my customers go, "How am I going to, what fertilizer do I buy for that?" Or, you know, I think, because I didn't go to agricultural school, I don't have the mindset that something cannot be done or that has to be done a certain way that is chemical or synthetic. I come at it from almost a 19th century perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so valuable. You have three varieties of tomatoes and I believe one variety of cucumber that are featured this year in the Showcase Garden in Fredericton, PEI. You've mentioned the Latta and the Mystery Keeper, but I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about the Mount Roma tomato and the Parade Cucumber that you have there as well.
Yeah, Mount Roma was a tomato I found only available from one outfit called Seeds Trust, which was a small outfit, and that they since went bust. But it's a nice little bush Roma tomato that, unbelievably, when you look at the plant, it's not a very big plant. But all you can see are tomatoes. You can hardly see the leaves. It's so bountiful. And it's just like a medium-sized Roma or paste tomato. And I thought, wow, there's nobody else growing that. I've got to try that. And once I grew it, I was just blew away by how productive and well-flavored it was. And thought, somebody else has got to offer this. So I did. And that's the story on that. There was a variety called Blunt Kopchkin I was just amazed by it. I had never seen so many tomato flowers on a tomato plant in my life. It would just be hundreds and hundreds of flowers on it. Holy smokes. If those all produce, I'm going to have gallons of tomatoes, small tomatoes, mind you, but I just could not get over the potential that would be in that. And fortunately for me, selecting for earliness, I was able to get it to produce 2 weeks earlier over a stretch of years than it had when I first got it. It's like not only a gorgeous plant, but a very tasty tomato and one that's not widely available. So that's a winner for me. That was a fun tomato to add to the list.
And the Parade Cucumber?
Parade Cucumber. because that was of Russian lineage. It was very early, very cold tolerant. I'm trying to remember. I think that was Gleckler's seeds. And that was a seed, that little family seed house that was also known for adventurous seeds and Deep South. And they said great dual purpose because it's not big, but it's not too small. So, I mean, you can use it as a pickler or you can use it as a small salad cucumber. And I thought right up my alley because I don't want to offer a lot of cucumbers. It simplifies the seed saving to have, you know, fewer cucumbers available for sale. But it was, yeah, it came in record time. I was surprised at how quickly it produces. And I was sold on the idea of, yeah, that dual purpose nature.
When I was looking through your brochure this year, another thing that I had never seen before was, I think it's pronounced gobo. Is that how you say that?
Yeah. It's, are you familiar with burdock?
Yeah, familiar with burdock.
Well, this is related to that, but it's a edible culinary version that comes from Asia, unlike the burdock we know in North America. And it's a nice, big, long root, very popular in Asian cuisine. And yeah, once I tried that, I thought that's a keeper. Nobody else is offering it. Why not?
It was very fun to go through your list and yeah, just see the things that I didn't recognize or right off the bat. If people are interested in ordering from you, it's probably a little late this year by the time this episode comes out, but next year, what is the best way for them to see what you have available and to order? And when should they do that, given sort of the demand that you have?
I've got a website. It's MapleFarm, all one word, .com. And that's maple with an extra P or apple with an M in front, Maple Farm. And I named it that because of the great quantity of maples and apples that are just came with this property that I bought many years ago. So you can go to maplefarm.com and you'll see what I have available online. There's also a little button there where you can press and send me a message if you like, you know, an email.
Do you sell out of a lot of varieties that you have still?
Yes, particularly for the ones that are perishable, like Jerusalem artichokes, Chinese artichokes, Egyptian onions. Those have a short shelf life. Mm-hmm. Seeds, I build up an inventory of those, and those are good for more than 1 year. I store them well and always, you know, germination test them. So I don't, and that gives me the option to grow different seeds that would cross with each other in alternate years so that I'm able to offer more seeds. In my declining years, now that I'm an old guy, I'm more subtracting things than adding things just to keep my finger in it because I love doing it and wanting to still be involved in it, but I'm not offering more. I'm kind of slimming down just to be able to keep it going.
Do you have any advice to people looking to get more involved in gardening or seed production or plant breeding or any of those things? What would you say to them as now someone who's on the more experienced side of that?
Oh, I can only deal with that from my own personal perspective, which is just seeing it as an adventure. You know, I just love finding something novel, something that isn't available, to see if it could possibly work in my area. I get the biggest kick out of, you know, even before you can get on your ground, dig up like Jerusalem artichokes and Chinese artichokes from the ground before it's workable, and eating stuff, you know, that's fresh produce from your own ground that, like, there's just nothing like it for me to be able to do that. Turkish rocket, you know, I'm harvesting that along with the sorrel super early, like just barely weeks after the snow is gone. You know, there's just so many different ways you can come at this love of gardening. I did it because I've always loved to eat. I've always loved to cook. I always love to have something different to work with. Yeah. And that's, so my lifestyle is a dream come true for that. Just always having something different to work with and try and turn other people on to. And that, to me, that's one of the great joys of the occupation I've taken on is that I can share this kind of experience with other people, and then other people do it with them, and it's kind of a pay it forward kind of exercise.
Well, listening to you talk, your passion for this absolutely comes through, and I think that's so fun. Thank you so much for making the time to do this and sharing your stories with us. This was a great episode.
Thanks for the compliments. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care, Greg.
Take care.
Seedheads is produced by the Bowda Family Initiative on Canadian Seed Security, a program of Seed Change, whose main office is located on the traditional, unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg people. To find episode transcripts and learn more about seed work in Canada, please visit seedsecurity.ca.